welcome back to another episode of The Ruthless Truth. First things first, it's time to get into our true update. Activists in Hillsborough County are fighting back against tax dollars being sent to Israel. One of our comrades and activists from Hillsborough, Taras, said this. For the last 7 years, Israeli entrepreneurs have been using county tax dollars to open their businesses in Hillsborough County through the Florida Business Accelerator, also FIBA. Through FIBA, private and public funds are allocated to Israeli citizens to set up shop anywhere in Florida, with claims they will drive economic growth and job creation. These are U.S. tax dollars being put into foreign hands, tax dollars that are being taken out of local hands. Handing over our money to companies like Extend, whose AI drones have been used on Palestinians and around the world, does not stimulate the local economy. It only lines the pockets of weapons dealers. We demand an end to the unethical misuse of taxpayer money and an end to the funding of foreign nationals when local communities are struggling. Hillsborough money can be better spent on improving infrastructure, providing affordable housing, and creating social programs that improve our quality of life. We don't need to give any more money to FIBA. We need that money for Hillsborough County and its constituents. Local social justice groups like Voices of Florida Fund traveled to the redistricting special session rally this Tuesday, April 28th, at the Florida State Capitol to advocate for no partisan maps. April 28th is the new first day of the unconstitutional partisan redistricting special session in Florida. Voices of Florida Fund Deputy Director Saide Smith spoke at the redistricting special session rally today at the Florida State Capitol before the special session began. They said that constituents choose their leaders. Leaders do not get to choose their constituents. They went on to say, entire communities will be carved up, their voices diluted, their representation stripped away, power will be pulled from the hands of the many and handed to the few. Will they try to divide us, pinning neighbor against neighbor with the tired us versus them rhetoric? They are quietly consolidating power for themselves. It is a distraction. We will not be distracted because Floridians have already spoken in 2010. We came together across party lines to pass the Fair District Amendments. We demanded fairness. We demanded transparency. We demanded that our democracy reflect the will of the people, not the ambitious politicians today. We will say it again. Enough is enough. Now, listeners, this is a blatant and a racist attack on the crumbs of choice and democracy that we have in this current system. But here's the thing. As workers, we shouldn't be in the position to be begging for scraps in the first place. We make this whole world run. We should be the ones running the world. That means a system where we don't just have control of the legislation, but we have control over everything. Everything. We should have control over our workplace, our communities, not just being forced to choose between politicians who have never truly represented us. All right. Last up. On our last air date, wildfires ravaged Georgia and North Florida. Local organizers from Party for Socialism and Liberation Gainesville said this statement. Big corporations have created a climate crisis across the Southeast with historic droughts and wildfires. We demand an immediate end to corporate water theft and full relief for all victims. End capitalism before it ends us. In Brantley County, Georgia, a massive wildfire has already engulfed nearly 50 homes. Only one of dozens of monstrous fires currently raging across South Georgia and North Florida. Meanwhile, residents are being forced to evacuate with no plan, no safety net, just chaos. This is the face of climate change, a permanent state of emergency that the billionaire class refuses to address. While they profit, we burn. This isn't exactly a natural disaster. It's the result of a system that treats land and water as resources to exploit for profit. Corporate control of our water and land is drying out ecosystems, intensifying fires, and leaving communities to deal with the consequences. We demand an end to corporate water extraction and the restoration of aquifers. We demand that public resources be directed into community-led fire response and permanent housing for those displaced. On May 1st, we strike for our lives. This is not a local issue. It is part of a national crisis driven by profit over people. We are joining the call for a national general strike. On May Day, we reclaim our power. No work, no school, no shopping. If the system will not protect our homes, we will stop the system. It is time to get into our main story today. We are joined by our returning guest, Ali Abdelkader, and we're very excited to have you on today, Ali.
Always excited to be on The Ruthless Truth. I was on here last time talking about Iran before Trump and Israel started this war at the end of February, and now the topic is more important than ever.
Absolutely. But let's start with what's been going on since you were last on with Iran, and let's talk about Trump's threats, especially this threat that we were all very worried about a few weeks ago, that he was going to end a civilization.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to lay out a little bit of the context, because just because I think it's important, you know, we've all been paying attention to the news over the past month, I'm sure. But let's just recap how this war started, which is that Trump and Israel, that is to say the United States and Israel, were in the process of negotiating with Iran, trying to figure out a solution to the crisis that exists. And the crisis that exists because the United States, you know, brings this up, saying they will not accept Iran having any sort of nuclear program. You know, they frame it as, we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but Iran has committed themselves to not pursuing nuclear weapons. They were not pursuing nuclear weapons. They had, as we talked about in our last episode, international inspectors at their facilities before the U.S. and Israel attacked them last year. Regardless, negotiations were taking place because as a part of this war, longer war on Iran, Trump and the United States had imposed economic sanctions on Iran. Basically, it's very hard for them to trade in the global economy, and they are looking to get those sanctions released, relieved, and have access to their financial assets that are stored overseas, that have been freezed. Well, while they were in the middle of negotiations, Oman, the country that had been facilitating those negotiations, announced right before the U.S. and Israel attacked that we were close to a breakthrough in the negotiations. That's what Oman's foreign minister had said, the mediating country. And the next day, the United States and Israel bomb Iran. They bomb targets all over the country, including targeting a girls' school in Minam, a city in Iran, bombing it with Tomahawk cruise missiles, killing over 200 little girls. Just as clear of a war crime as could be, targeting a school of children, of young children. And also on that same day, assassinating the supreme leader of Iran. And what's very clear is that the United States, the extent of their strategy going into this war was that if they assassinate the leadership of Iran, the entire country would fall in a few days. The people would rise up. They would attack the military targets. They'd obliterate the military targets. That is to say, the U.S. and Israel would assassinate the top leadership, which they did. They assassinated some of the top leaders in Iran. But then the people would rise up. Well, that didn't happen. In fact, this war has proved to be an extremely unifying force inside of Iran for Iranians, because it turns out Iranians are pretty united on, we want to stop this country that's bombing and killing us. And that has led up to Iran, first of all, retaliating against the attacks by the U.S. And their primary method of retaliating has been to attack United States bases, military bases across the region. There's many U.S. military bases in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia. So we're talking Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq, but also attacking Israel pretty extensively as well. And we don't have exact numbers on the damage that the Iranians have inflicted on the U.S., but it's severe enough to the point that all these military bases are pretty much evacuated, because they recognize it is not feasible to have any military personnel there because they will just become targets. The number of confirmed U.S. service personnel that have been killed so far is 13, with hundreds more wounded. So the U.S. has completely evacuated these bases in the Middle East, but Iran has also targeted expensive military hardware in the region, such as radars that are used to search, you know, look out for missiles that are coming in, a very expensive billions of dollars worth of equipment. They've targeted $1 billion worth of missile interceptors and billions of dollars of missiles have been used by the United States not only to bomb Iran, but also to try and intercept these missiles that are coming in, trying to stop the missiles and drones that are coming from Iran towards Israel and towards the U.S. bases. And the problem for the United States is that Iran has very advanced missiles. They have a very sophisticated system of launching the missiles from trucks, so they can be launched from anywhere. So it's not easy to just attack where the missiles are coming from inside Iran. This is why, despite a month of very intense bombing, the United States was not able to stop Iran from inflicting significant damage to Israel and the United States and their allies, that is the Gulf states. They also have very cheap drones. Now, these drones can cost as little as $20,000 or less to make. They just attach a bomb on there and they fly directly on the target. Boom, blows up. Well, in order to intercept it, you need to use millions of dollars worth of interceptor missiles. So the calculus on attacking versus defense, it becomes very skewed towards the attacker. And the United States, on top of all of this, what should have been seen coming from the United States was that Iran shut down the Strait of Hormuz. And the Strait of Hormuz is one of the most critical waterways in the entire world. 20% of all oil that comes through the sea comes through the Strait of Hormuz. 25% of all liquefied natural gas that comes over the sea goes through the Strait of Hormuz. Almost 40% of fertilizers that go through the sea go through the Strait of Hormuz. It is an extremely critical waterway. All of these Gulf countries rely on the Strait of Hormuz to, their tankers go through it to ship through their products. Well, it's been closed to traffic, at least to traffic that is associated with the U.S. or its allies since this war began. Iran has proved that they are able to stop ships from coming through the Strait of Hormuz. And this has caused massive economic damage to the entire world felt here. I mean, that's why our gas prices are so high, because oil is not present in the global economy, because so much of it is stuck right now in the Middle East because of this war that the United States and Israel have launched. And because of all of this, because of the deep strategic failure of the U.S. not being able to stop Iran from closing the strait, the U.S. not being able to stop Iran from defending itself, from being able to retaliate against U.S. bases, the U.S. was forced to the negotiating table. And despite that, Trump tried very, very intensely on the way to the negotiating table to try and force Iran to back down, to try and force Iran to the negotiating table on terms that would be more amenable to the United States, to not be such a strategic failure for the United States. Because this is very embarrassing for Donald Trump. He's been talking up that this war would be so easy, it would be over in a few days, and a few days in, he's saying, you know, it's only been 3 days, give me a few days. A few weeks in, he's like, it's only been a few weeks, you know, give me a few months. And now, very recently, he was speaking at the White House saying, well, Vietnam lasted for 18 years, so like, how can you say this has lasted long, right? Really, we're comparing this with Vietnam now. That's how bad the situation has gotten for Donald Trump. It's a massive strategic failure for the United States. On the way out, before a ceasefire was signed, and I want to talk more about the ceasefire in a moment, but on the way out, that threat was made that you mentioned earlier, Ira, where Trump went to Truth Social, his boutique social media platform, to announce that he was going to be attacking power plants, he was going to be attacking bridges. And unless Iran opened up the Strait of Hormuz, and he announced an ultimatum Tuesday night, 8:30 p.m., and that day in the morning, Tuesday, he said that an entire civilization was going to die tonight. That is the most open call for mass murder, for genocide, that I have heard from a United States president, at least in my lifetime. You know, this kind of statement is, I think, would be pretty commonplace in Israel. The United States is usually not so open about their intent to commit war crimes, to kill an entire civilization. No, they didn't say we're going to kill the entire government. We're going to destroy their entire military. I mean, the U.S. has been claiming that they've destroyed Iran's navy, and clearly that wasn't true. They said an entire civilization. That is a direct threat on the civilians of Iran. But despite that, later that day, Trump claimed that they had made a deal with Iran, that they had accepted a 10-point plan that had been posed by Iran earlier as the basis for a negotiation to take place. A two-week ceasefire went into effect. We are now on week three of that ceasefire, but things have deteriorated pretty substantially. But I want to give the floor back to you, Ira, our host.
Of course. And we will get into that in a moment. But I want to talk about one of the big reasons why the ceasefire fell apart. And that was over whether or not Lebanon would be included in the ceasefire, because there was a moment where the U.S. and Israel were saying, no, Lebanon's not included. And Iran saying, yes, they would be included. And then Israel dropped 100 bombs in 10 minutes on Lebanon. So I kind of want to get into why that is a important aspect of the ceasefire negotiations.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the 10 points that Iran had put forward in their 10-point proposal that the U.S. said was an acceptable basis to start from, which is that there should be a ceasefire across all of the Middle East, that is to say, including Lebanon, because Lebanon has also been a part of this war since the beginning stages of it, as the resistance in Lebanon, in solidarity with Iran, had entered the front, and Israel had been brutally attacking Lebanon. Over a million people internally displaced inside of Lebanon. Israel would announce entire neighborhoods, entire villages, everyone needs to evacuate because they were going to bomb indiscriminately in those areas. And that's what they did. So over a million people, that's to say almost a fifth of the entire population of Lebanon, was internally displaced. I mean, you have people living on tents on the beaches in Lebanon. It's brutal. And that was before the ceasefire. But I want to kind of talk a little bit about Lebanon. Listeners should remember that during the U.S. And let me repeat that again. Sorry, editor. Listeners should remember that during the Israeli genocidal war against Gaza, Lebanon was a front in that war as well, with the resistance in Lebanon in solidarity with the people of Gaza firing missiles into Israel to try and open up a second front. And Israel responded in a very brutal way, completely indiscriminately attacking Lebanon in late 2024, starting out with the Pager attacks and then just bombing entire apartment complexes and inflicting heavy damage to Lebanon. And a ceasefire was reached in that conflict in Lebanon that Israel routinely violated. They would basically, whenever they wanted, bomb Lebanon and claim that they were doing it to try and attack Hezbollah, which is the resistance inside of Lebanon that originates out of a resistance to Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon from the 70s and particularly from the 80s. Okay. Hezbollah. The big demand that Israel has out of Lebanon, and this is a demand that they've been pushing for years, but especially in the last few months, is that the Lebanese government needs to disarm Hezbollah. Lebanon has an army, and Hezbollah is a paramilitary group, but they're also a political party. And their demand is that the Lebanese government needs to disarm Hezbollah or Israel is going to attack Lebanon. So they're saying, Lebanese people, you need to kill each other, or we're going to go in there and we're going to do the killing instead. And we've landed in the second square there. But it's important to say that in Lebanon, the government really doesn't represent the actual people of Lebanon. The entire government of Lebanon comes from this insane system that the French set up on their way out, where different sects, different sort of cultural and religious groups are promised different positions inside of government. For example, the prime minister always must be from one sect. The president always must be a Maronite Christian. And on top of that, the government of Lebanon is a collaborator government. It is a government that is not interested in trying to achieve its own sovereignty. It is a government that is trying to negotiate better terms with the United States, which dominates the region, and also negotiate with Israel. The Lebanese army, despite all the attacks that have been happening in Lebanon, have not tried to defend Lebanon once. They have not fired a single bullet. Not in 2024. Israel attacked Lebanon in August, and not this year. So after the ceasefire was reached with Iran and the United States and Israel stopped attacking Iran, Israel massively intensified its campaign in Lebanon, almost out of a sort of revenge, just to say, we are not happy about this ceasefire. We're going to take it out on Lebanon. We're going to take it out on the people of Lebanon. And Israel actually has this ambition of trying to conquer, especially the south of Lebanon. They want the villages that they've completely destroyed there. Some of these villages, which go back thousands of years, they've completely destroyed them, and they want to occupy south of Lebanon up to the Latani River. And that's important to say. The United States, it seems, forced Israel to kind of accept, at least in theory, a ceasefire. But that has not stopped Israel from attacking journalists, bombing journalists, assassinating journalists inside of Lebanon. That happened just this week. And Lebanon continues to be a country that is in turmoil, is under attack by Israel and by the United States. And just like with Iran, it's in an uneasy pause, but clearly this cannot hold.
And it really goes to show that these pro-Western governments, you know, they'll do nothing. They'll do nothing to protect their own people. So having this subservience to Israel, the United States, it's, you know, I feel like there's a lot of pushback against Iran's defiance against Israel's attacks. And, you know, they don't want to be in a situation like Lebanon. Like, you know, they're essentially getting... Like it's an itty bitty country. It's the size of Connecticut, I believe. So it's very wild how they're just, I don't want to say bullied, but you know, kind of like being like they're, you know, all of their Israel's frustration is just being taken out on them. But I want to talk about essentially Trump failed. Why he's failed and why he is most likely going to continue to fail in his goal here. Like, you know, like you were saying, he's comparing it to Vietnam. It's very clear that there is no end in sight in this war. And I want to make it clear to the audience that this isn't going to be over anytime soon.
So we're in a very difficult situation where we have Donald Trump, who is trying to dictate to the entire world how the world should be run. And he's come up against a country that is willing to defend themselves, not only willing, but they have the means, both militarily and strategically, to defend themselves. And already there is press, there is reporting coming out that if the Strait of Hormuz was to reopen now, an economic crisis globally is already locked in, essentially, at this point. Fertilizers and oil are not getting where they need to be, especially in Asia, especially in the global south. And we are not going to be completely insulated from that. Even though we're here in the United States, even though the United States is an oil exporter, that's one thing that Trump has been saying. Well, the United States exports oil, so less oil in the world is a good thing for us. Well, unless you have stocks, a lot of stocks in oil companies, unless you run weapons companies, you are coming out of this war a lot worse. You are going to be paying for it at the pump, and you are going to be paying for it with higher prices for everything. And that is assuming that Trump reaches a deal where the Strait of Hormuz is opened immediately. And just to recap what has happened over the course of the ceasefire with Iran specifically, because we spoke about Lebanon, Trump is refusing to meet the Iranians where they're at. He is refusing to accept the kind of demands, the very basic demands, I think, that Iran is putting forward, which is that Iran wants to be paid for the losses that they have suffered in this war. They want reparations. I think that makes sense. The U.S. Launched a war of aggression against Iran, bombed their civilian infrastructure. Iran wants to be paid. That makes sense. Iran wants relief from economic sanctions, something that they were negotiating with and something that they were willing to negotiate over before this war. And they want access to their financial assets that have been frozen overseas by the United States. They want access to their financial assets that they belong to them. They also are not willing to accept any sort of handing over of their civilian nuclear uranium stockpile. They said that they're willing to dilute it, and they're willing to have international observers come to dilute their stockpile so that it would be less refined, which would mean that it would be less easy for them theoretically to build some sort of weapon, which, again, they have no plans of doing. But they, as a measure of good faith, they're willing to do that.
Very generous offer. There will not be a nuclear program. It's like, how many observers have to go into that country?
Right, exactly. But the United States isn't interested in that. The United States is interested in these sort of maximalist demands. Another, of course, the biggest point of contention is about the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. Iran says that they have a right now to collect tolls from the Strait of Hormuz because it exists within its territorial waters. The United States thinks that this is out of the question. And so as retaliation for the United States not getting what it wants out of these negotiations, it launched a naval blockade of Iran's ports, saying any ship that tries to land in an Iranian port in the Strait of Hormuz, that is to say in the past the Strait of Hormuz, that is to say in the Persian Gulf, or any ship that is bringing goods, especially oil, out of it, they will be intercepted by the American Navy. And they already have intercepted at least one tanker. Now, as retaliation, Iran has closed down the Strait of Hormuz again. And they have used their Navy, which Donald Trump has been claiming that the Iranian Navy has been completely destroyed. That's one of the few things they bragged about. We've completely destroyed Iran's Navy. Well, the Iranian Navy seized multiple tankers that were not complying with their demands that they do not go through the Strait of Hormuz. Clearly, unless Trump is willing to accept a massive, massive humiliation on the global stage, which it seems that he is not willing to do that, because let's be clear, we are currently living, when it comes to foreign policy especially, under a dictatorship of Donald Trump and his billionaire friends. There seem to be no checks and balances stopping Trump from doing whatever he wants. Congress? They're not interested in passing a war powers resolution. Congress is, in this country at least, supposed to be in charge of saying who we go to war with. On this, they have nothing to say. And what seems to be the objection from many Democrats is they oppose how Donald Trump is conducting this war, but not the fact that he's conducting it. And they're not willing to actually put up a fight because ultimately they feel like they're on the same side as Trump against Iran. Okay, so no one is standing up against Trump's dictates. So that means that this war is most likely going to restart after Trump and Israel have the chance to restock their supplies of missile interceptors, their supply of bombs. Very expensive. Pentagon asked for $200 billion to replenish their arms. They're asking for $1.5 trillion for the budget for next year. At the same time that Trump says, sorry, but we can't do daycare. The government can't do daycare. We need to pay it for the military. That's where all our money is going. Our money is going into missile interceptors, military hardware, all while we don't have a say in it whatsoever. And all for what? All to fuel Trump's ego, all so that he can have the ability to dictate what happens all over the world, to try and conquer another country's oil. This is an extremely unpopular war, a very stupid war. It's clearly not going to be successful. They will have to unleash genocidal, apocalyptic levels of violence to even approach any sort of end to the crisis that they have built for themselves. And as an American, but also just as a member of the human race, I'm terrified by what is happening. And I feel the need for us here in the United States to oppose this war before it digs us into an even deeper crisis, because people don't realize what is just around the corner.
Absolutely. You know, it's like, yes, oil prices will go up. Yes, everything will get more expensive. Yes. You know, these endless military budgets are the reason that we can't provide for our citizens' basic needs. But beyond that, just, you know, your love of humanity should compel you to stand against this. But the question is, a lot of people, you know, will immediately ask, how do we fight back? How can us, the working class, the workers, show that we are against this and have our voice heard?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it goes into, all of the other opposition to Trump's widely unpopular agenda, right? How do we oppose ICE? How do we oppose the rolling back of our democratic rights? You know, how do we oppose Trump as a whole? How do we oppose his billionaire friends, the MAGA movement? It's all tied together. We have to understand that if we want an anti-war movement to be successful, it has to be adopted by the masses of people who are opposing Trump. And then the question becomes a strategy of how do we oppose Trump properly? Because if the answer is wait for midterms, I think we're in trouble. With the rate of action that Trump is taking here, we can't afford to wait for midterms. We can't afford to elect Democrats who, frankly, once they're in office, are not seemingly not able to mount any sort of real opposition to Trump and the Trump agenda. The answer has to be mass action by the people. And what I believe and what many people are fighting for is around the idea of a general strike. What does that mean? It means workers committing themselves to not go to work, to shut down society, because working people make society run, until our demands are met. And that is something that has the power to change entire societies. And it's what the ruling class and Trump ultimately fear most is a class conscious working class in this country trying to take action because they are tired of the political system that we live under. And that's something that is going to require a lot of work to build. It's something that is not going to be easy, but it's something that more and more people